kinds of exposure, of declination, of latitudes where you can put your arrays and get coverage close to optimal. And if you the details of what I mean by equivalent uniform area, you can see the Rassier stock. Anywhere from around 25 to around 60 degrees of latitude is okay. But if you have a smaller aperture, like 55 or 60 degrees, you have to be more careful about where to place the arrays. So unlike in telescope array, it would be very bad for GCOS to only have scintillators. We must have something more sensitive to near horizontal showers, such as water Cherenkov and or radio. But also, there are some other possibilities which would be a little less good but still viable if for some reason you wanted to resort to them. For example, having one large array close to the equator and one smaller array close to the opposite pole. Yeah, probably the south should be north and vice versa, because there isn't much land around the minus 75 degrees still. Or there is a possibility of having three arrays, a big one on the equator and two slightly smaller ones, symmetric around it at mid latitudes.
Okay, so thank you, Armando. Are there any questions for Armando from the Zoom participants? Okay, so I don't have any questions. It's clear, because I think this is also like something that we already discussed also in the other GCOS workshop, but we'll see this, so we can, but it's nice, Armando, that you're doing all the studies to be able to see where we place the arrays.
Thanks.
Now, speaking about placing the arrays, there is a talk of Pierre now, okay. And that he's actually going to show us that there are some preferential places on the Earth where we should maybe think about placing these arrays.
So we see the, okay. So what I want to present today is essentially a summary of a paper which was published a few years ago. And this effect was visible on OG data, but not enough to be exploited for reasons that I will explain later. So
can you hear Pierre?
Sorry?
Somebody from Zoom can confirm that you can hear Pierre?
Sorry?
He is a bit quiet, says Alan Kuhlman in the chat. But yes.
So Pierre, if you want to come,
switch off that mic.
Or you can come here to speak, maybe.
Or you can
yeah, that's what I'm saying, Pierre.
You know, you can switch off.
Questions and it becomes very interactive, very non-interactive.
Okay, Okay, so the idea is that if you consider an horizontal shower, the tail of an horizontal shower contains only muons, and the magnetic field of the Earth will separate the positive and the negative muons. So you can see in this plot what happens at different angles and different, different theta angles and different magnetic field magnitude, okay, and so you see that you can obtain really a shape which is completely different, kind of butterfly effect. So to represent, we have tried to parameterize this effect. You see that, for example, a good way of parameterize is to use the square root of r, square root of the distance variable and the phi. Okay, you have a relatively regular shape, and you can fit this shape by a sine function, like something like that. And the dependence on square root of r is relatively smooth. So what we did is to obtain this parametrization. You have a term which is the magnetic effect itself, and another term which is the asymmetry, because of course this is a view transverse in the transverse plane to the shower, then you have some symmetry, but on the ground, you have a forward-backward asymmetry, of course. So we use this to represent all that, and with this function, you can nicely represent what happens, provided you give a dependence of the lambda, alpha, and beta coefficients as function of rho, which rho is essentially square root of r. So we take a second order polynomial, and then what happens is that if you consider the a given model, okay, the models I will show are probably obsolete and you can forget about that, but the advantage is that probably any model will give similar results. So if you consider now with this QGSJet model, you see an alignment. Yes, in abscissa you have the X max. Actually, it's X mu max, but X mu max is correlated to X max. As a function of X max, the quantities alpha zero, alpha one, and lambda one. The other ones are not really significant. You see an alignment, an almost perfect alignment, and you see that the proton and iron data are on the same straight line, and probably also the intermediate nuclei. So you have some universality of this relation, okay? And now what is interesting is that if you consider different models, you for each one you have some universality, but the universality depends on the model. That is, you have different lines for different models. And so the idea is that we can obtain from that an absolute criterion to see whether a model represents actually what happens or not. Okay, so you have a sensitivity of alpha one, alpha zero, alpha one, and lambda one. So you have three quantities to use for. And now the point for that is that you need, of course, a high magnetic field if possible, and this is absolutely false in OG. OG, you have the worst possible situation, and also the best situation is where this magnetic field is vertical, because in that case you will affect all directions in the same way. So where on the Earth do you find something like that? It's essentially everywhere. No, not everywhere, but essentially in the north of Asia, that is Siberia, something like that, or north of China. Now, how to detect that? You see that essentially you want to, of course, observe showers when that have been detected and measured by something else, for example, radio or FD or whatever you want. So on the right part here, you have the zone of detection of the shower, and you suppose you can measure X max, okay? And then you observe here on this specific detector, an array of vertical planes, you observe the content of muons, okay? And of course, you can imagine that if you have a very large zone which is equipped to detect showers, you can put this array somewhere in the middle. Of course, you don't want to cover all the, it's just a local test of the models. You cannot cover all that. And ideally, what you have to put here is something which could cover, for example, 10 by 10 square kilometers, something like that, with a distance between the detector of the order of 500 meters. Because you see, what you want to examine is something which is around 1 kilometer from the core. And if you want some precision, you need to be relatively close to the core. So this is something that can be added, it's a specific addition to the shower, but with the advantage of a constraint which seems to be independent of the nature of the primary. Thank you.
So thank you, Pierre. So are there any questions for Pierre?
So all details in the, are in the paper, as you mentioned. Yes, I forgot to say, we can, in this paper, we didn't try to exploit the time structure, but probably with a good time resolution, we could also exploit this time structure because the different ways to come from muon to come to Earth depends on the curvature, depends, and you could see an effect of maybe 10 nanoseconds. So with a precise time structure, you could also probably find some constraints.
But Pierre, I have a question. So this is only for 70 degrees and above, or which angles you're doing?
No, in principle, you can do that for whatever you want. But you see that if, at for example, this is theta equals 764, something like that, the effect is very small. Essentially, you need a long travel, a long distance between the X max and the ground to see clearly this effect of the separation of mucus from the minus. And also, you see that if the deviation is small, the effect is quadratic. And so, to see clearly the effect, you have to go in this zone of linear effect. And here, you have a very high field, but this is not possible. You cannot obtain more than 65 microtesla on the Earth. Okay? Or you go to large theta. But okay, between 70. And 90, you have a lot of possibilities.
Okay, there's a question from Lorenzo.
Yes, very nice idea. And did you understand what are the differences? So you get different responses from different models. Do you know what are they related to? For instance, is it the spectrum, the muon spectrum from the which is different different models, or do you know what is it related to?
It's difficult to give a precise answer to that because it's a combination of the distance and the energy. Okay, so it's something that depends on the multi-dimensional. Phase space, that is the phase space of the muons. And so I have no idea of, I'm not an expert of the model, so I don't know what is.
It would be good to understand, right? I had the same question actually, and was thinking what makes the showers look different in the different models.
Yes, sure, and, sure.
So if we think of tests of harmonic interaction models, of course, if they look different, it would be good to understand, okay. What are the differences? I mean, which properties of the air showers are different in the different models that make them look different?
Yes, but that you have to, yeah. To expect.
But interesting, in general, it's both different, right? You know, there are different letter distributions as well as the energy spectra.
Yeah, but that's exactly the question. I mean, is it the time structure, is it the lateral distribution, or what are the features? Because they are related to different harmonic interaction features, right? Like, I mean, if you think of lateral distribution, BT, I mean, but time structure, maybe again, something else, which is different in the models. But then you would need, I mean, to trace back, I mean, to tune the models, right?
But maybe with that, you could kill some models.
Yeah. No, but still you would like to understand, okay, yes. What was the feature that killed that model? Right?
Okay.
Thank you, Pierre. So I don't know if you still have to have a discussion now or we go on with the session. And actually, Marcus couldn't make it finally. So we have a talk about the reconfigurations by Alan Watson. Alan?
Yeah, I'm here. Just trying to get my screen going. Can you see that?
Yes.
Is it full screen? No.
Not yet.
Oh God, how do I do that? Full screen somewhere. Bit time. Oh well, I think you'll just have to accept it as it is. I don't know. Right. So I was asked by Joanna, first of all, I should start by saying, I don't share the traditional view that I'm sorry not to be with you. I had a look at the temperatures in Wuppertal, and it's way outside my normal operating range. So I'm very happy to be in Scotland, where it's sunny and 20 degrees centigrade, rather than in Wuppertal, where I think it's nearer 30. Anyway, just a few general remarks on the surface detectors. I think at least one site, there should be a large area with closely spaced detectors. Some of the older members of the Auger collaboration will know that I wanted to have an infilled section at the beginning before, as we were building the whole array, but I lost that battle with Jim Cronin. So I do think that having a closely packed array would be very, very valuable. And at one site, you should really seriously consider that over maybe 10 square meters with a very close spacing of perhaps one and a half Mollier units. The dynamic range of the detectors is very important. And the area of the detectors ideally should be larger than Auger, but that's probably determined by the road width, which is what determined the diameters in the Auger detector. As for the dynamic range, I remind you that Lindsley achieved 0.5 to 5 times 10 to the 5 on his compressed Volcano Ranch array. And we should be aiming for something like that. We really know nothing about what goes on close to the core of a shower of, say, 10 EEV. And surely this is a place to test forward physics. Also, we must try to measure shower to shower differences in the LDF. And this is an important measurement, in my view, related to mass measurement. So that's really my small contribution. And I want to turn to some work that I've been involved with Olivier, Isabel, Quentin, Marcus, who should be giving this talk, David Schmidt. And just a little bit of history. Back in 1969, Michael Hillis analyzed a small number of events from the Havre Park array, which at that time, the engineering array phase was just a star-shaped geometry, a pretty terrible geometry. But he found that if you analyzed the data with two Parlaw functions, that you got a small fluctuation at about 500 meters, something less than 12%. And this led us to use this parameter in the Havre Park work. And that really extended into Auger without terribly much thought in the early days when we decided really intuitively that we would use 1,000 meters as the optimum distance for measuring size. A more detailed study was undertaken largely by David Newton to look at this with different lateral distributions of power law, the Havre Park function, and NKG type function. And we found that the optimum values of the distance at which the fluctuations would be small, and this was the RMS spread, was something a little below 1 kilometer, with very little dependence on zenith angle, some dependence actually if the detectors were saturated, and very little dependence on energy. So that seemed to point to using 1,000 meters. We were already wedded to that, and it seemed a little bit picky to go for something like 960 or 970, especially as we hadn't settled on the lateral distribution function. Now, the other results that came from that was that for a triangular geometry, two-thirds of the spacing of the detectors is an appropriate choice for R op. And this was used and checked for the 750 meter array. It was never checked, as I understand it, for the telescope array with a square geometry. And if you go back to the picture of Hillis, where he found 500 meters being optimum for a 500 meter spacing, it makes you realize that there is no obvious reason why there should be a relationship that doesn't depend on the geometry, on the layout of the detectors. I remind you that Auger has a triangular grid with 1,500 meters, the telescope array a square grid with 1,200 meters. Now, if you do a simulation using the telescope array geometry with Wather-Chernikoff detectors for two energies and the range of angles, this is for 18.5 log of 18.5, not 53 degrees. You see that R opt is somewhere right around 1,250 meters. Sorry, 1,250 meters, whereas a decade higher in energy for the same angular range, R opt is about 1,400 meters. The difference between having the station saturated or non-saturated is the difference between the green and the blue, whereas the red is everything. And you see that there's a very a small effect, that there are very small differences at large values of R opt. Looking in rather more detail at one zenith angle, the vertical for a proton with the QDS jet model, you see that for the triangular grid of Auger using an NKG function, that for different energies, the low energy is in blue, the highest energy in red, you see that everything settles nicely round about a kilometer, just that had been shown in the work by David Newton. Whereas if you go to the square grid, then what you find is that you go up in energy, R opt moves to larger and larger values. And this, of course, means that if you're using 800 meters as your value, that the precision with which you measure it, rather than being around about 2% to 3% at minimum, it goes up to higher values at the larger energies. So it gets worse and worse as you go to higher energies. Now, you also have to worry about the fluctuations in R opt. And this arises because of the way in which beta, the lateral distribution parameter, changes. And the biases are very small in the case of a Water-Cherenkov detector on a triangular grid, but they're asymmetric in the case of the square grid. So this leads to some take-home messages. The layout of an array has an impact on R opt. The difference between a triangular and square grid is important. R opt dependence should be investigated for whatever geometries are planned. And it's desirable, of course, to choose one that doesn't depend on energy. Unfortunately, we don't actually know why there is this difference. Of course, it comes from the Monte Carlos, but those of you who know me well will know that I am not really a great Monte Carlo fan, and I'd like to feel I understood this in some intuitive way. And I know of no other systematic study of triangular versus square. I can't find anything in the literature, I mean, going back to historical times, as to why people went for triangular grids. But these were always used by MIT, by Volcano Ranch at Hubbard Park, and at Gasa at Yakutsk, many places. But square grids are rather rare. They're used at Pescada, Casa, and at Sugar, and would have been used on Auger North. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Are there questions for Alan?
Well, maybe a remark that you were very quick with your slide 7, but I think there is also, when you look at azimuthal dependencies, my expectation would be you see patterns in the square grid and less structure in the triangular ones.
And yes, that's one of the lines we're actually following, Jörg. You're quite correct. I think that's one factor. And also, I think you get densities clustered, signals clustered in particular places with the different geometries. But it's not intuitively obvious. And we are working hard on this at the moment. And also have open discussions with Telescope Array about this.
Yeah, and since you mentioned Cascade there on the slide, I know at least from my time working on the calorimeter, there we did see the calorimeter, also the basic units were square, so we had somehow a rectangular grid, if you want. So also did see in azimuthal dependencies, you did see sort of preference directions, yeah, parallel and orthogonal to the layout, and then on the 45 degree line, and I don't know, I think, yeah, this is somehow, to me, this looks like a general, yeah, feature. So my
story, that's interesting. I asked you, Hannes Knapp, as to why Cascade had gone for a square, and he told me it was for German desire for precision.
that's really interesting. I wasn't aware of that, actually, but my thinking was also with what Jörg just said. I mean, that you have these generalities, right, depending on the azimuth position. Maybe that's the way to understand that in simulations, to study that as a function of the azimuthal angle, to see whether it's related to that. But it's very interesting.
Yeah, actually, Marcus has been working on it. It's a pity he's not well and not able to talk about it. He has been circulating within our small group that very idea of azimuthal differences. Yeah. I think it's probably a mixture of a number of subtle effects.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a
Lorenzo
question by Lorenzo.
Yeah, I was wondering if there is what the alternatives of to using R optimum, for instance, the integral of the LDF, if it works better or not. If you know it or
the integral of the LDF. At Haver Park in the early days, we used the essentially an integral which was between 100 and 1,000 meters to find the energy. There's something like 1/150th of the shard of the primary energy, if I remember correctly. It falls between 100 meters and a kilometer, but it is very dependent on the lateral distribution. And if I remember rightly, the differences were something like 70% as a Galera spread of 12% from the work that Michael Hillis did.
Thanks.
And then, Andreas?
Yeah, just to Lorenzo. I mean, at Cascade, we used also the integral. And as far as I remember, the main reason was that it was very difficult to find an R-opt because of the observation level of sea levels. That means the fluctuations to find an optimum R was quite difficult, at least with with what we had at that time, also on simulations and so on. So, but then this leads me also to my question. Alan, have you also considered the influence on R-opt on the observation level? If you are closer to sea level or deeper in the atmosphere or at a higher observation level, does this also have a big influence on the optimum R?
No, I would be very surprised if altitude had any effect. I think it's a geometrical effect. I have to say, we never did any calculations for Haver Park. The simulations that Michael Hillis, well, he didn't do simulations. He analyzed 50 events. It was all based on 50 events because in the late 60s and early 70s, the amount of computing power you had was really tiny. I mean, he did all of this on a machine with, I don't remember, 150K of memory.
So Andreas, probably, you know, when you go to higher energies, you would see more and more inclined showers. You know, most of the showers have larger zenith angles. And then this degeneracy effect of the geometry gets more important. And that may be an effect also why it changes with increasing energy.
Yeah, I mean, at Cascade, we have already seen, so to say, an electron component coming from the muon decay. And this might also have a little bit of influence. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. William?
Alan, are you aware whether there was also a study with a complete random position, so basically no grid?
I've always thought that having a random shard array would be the ideal way to do things. But you might choose a random shard array that wasn't optimum. But I've never investigated. It's been a thought experiment for 30 years, maybe 40 years. But you know, has somebody actually done this?
Yes, Etienne. He showed it at an Auger meeting many years ago.
Oh, did he? I must try and find that out. Yeah.
And people didn't like it.
I'm sure they didn't, but I'm sure it's sensible.
Can I directly comment on this? Because we have in Aera, we have non-regular spacing and also in LOFAR. And it's really very, very cumbersome, huh? Because everything changes with location, your efficiency, your resolution. So I don't know, at least this is my personal view, is that this non-regular arrays like we have in LOFAR and Aera is a lot of additional work. And I think we can, of course, have infills or something like this, but I would strongly, with my experience, I would constant spacings in certain places, eh? And then you have a denser infill. This is fine, but I don't know, not random because
Jörg is German.
I mean, no. But the point, this is true. But the point is, you know, like in Aera, the efficiency change.
This is not this random, because Aera has a grid, but it has different zones of grid. So I mean, of course, it must be that the number of stations is large enough so that you have still a constant density.
Well, I can tell that a LOFAR is built on purpose on this logarithmic spiral because it's a radio astronomical instrument and you want to have as many baseline combinations as possible. So there is a lot of thought for radio astronomy, but for us, it's really a chaotic structure, and you're really, you, yeah, things like aperture and even on time and stuff like this is always a nightmare. So it's, I don't know, you want a real like white noise random, okay, then this, yeah.
And then of course, somebody has to look into this. But so the tendency is really constant, then of course it could really work. Okay. I also remember the contribution by Etienne, now that you said it.
Alan, I also have a question. So does this come from the scintillators? So if you are having a quadratic array made out of water Cherenkov, it's like a 3D detector, do you see the same effect?
No, it's nothing to do with whether you use scintillators or water Cherenkov detectors. If you look, just see if I can find the right slide. This is a simulation done with TA with water Cherenkov detectors. This is a simulation done with water Cherenkov detectors on a triangular grid and scintillators on a square grid. I can't recall if we did scintillators on a triangular grid, but I'm so convinced it's a geometrical effect. I wouldn't really worry about that at all. The computer program, if you think about an analysis of a shower, which is what we're talking about here, the computer program doesn't know whether it's dealing with a scintillator or water Cherenkov detector. You just give it a density at a particular point.
No, but I was just thinking about the divergence of the particles. So if you have a flux detector and you have particles, then your signals actually are depending on the angle of the incident particles. So this changes with the energy. So that's why I was wondering.
Yeah, I'll think about that, Joanna, but I'm a bit surprised. But I'll think about it. We can maybe talk about it in Nijmegen. Okay.
Good, so thank you. And I don't know if there's any other discussions that we should have today, because actually tomorrow we are going to have a full session with lots of contributions. So I don't know if anybody wants to raise any other points. If not, then we leave the floor to the rating people.
Yes.
Thank you, Alan, for the presentation to all the speakers from the
session.
You're
welcome.
Should we sit here, you know? Then we can both speak and... Okay. Thanks, Joanna. You actually made up some time because, like a miracle, we are back on schedule again, which is always nice.
That's not why. Tomorrow
I'm going to be very
late, so that's why I'm like making good impression
for
session, and the second is going to be.
Still doing something? Yes. So if things go well, let me see. Ah, yes, you can see. Okay. Well, like the other two detection techniques, we have collected a few thoughts, contributions about radio, and well, I have a few slides here which Tim, Julian, and I sort of in a brainstorming session collected some very general thoughts. Partly this is repetition, but just to see where we are. So I think it's obvious that with radio we have a very clean measurement of the electromagnetic components, because muons don't really radiate. So this is really a very clean measurement. And also we have nearly 100% duty cycle. So only in case of thunderstorms or so we cannot measure, but it's, I don't know what it is, 98% or something like this in practice. So that means with this clean measurement of the electromagnetic component, you can contribute in several ways to what we are doing here. So one is with the astronomy part is we can contribute to mass separation. And this depends now on your spacing for denser arrays. And we just heard from Ellen, there was an advertisement to have at least 8 denser parts. So if it's dense enough, then with radio, you can with vertical showers, you get an independent Xmax measurement. And this is then really some added value. If you have a more sparser array, then in a hybrid mode together with some other component like a water Cherenkov detector, you can do electrons with the radio and then muons with the ground array. So you can do electron muon separation. And well, yeah, then you have your mass and at the end, the rigidity. I think very important, maybe I should have put this first here, that with radio, we get this absolute energy scale, which I think is quite nice as a fixed point for interaction studies or also for the astrophysics, you always need the energy. And then if you have a sparse array, then yeah, you can measure charged cosmic rays, neutrinos, gamma rays. And on the neutral particles will be more remarks by Julian and Washington in a few minutes. And then what we do, for example, in Auger, we have this 750 meter arrays where we have underground muon detectors and radio antennas. So then this is for the particle physics aspects, of course, very valuable that you have here. Clean measurement of the individual components without complicated unfolding in the segmented water Cherenkov detector. I think you always have some sort of unfolding and some remaining dependency on hadronic models. I think this is really a clean measurement. Yeah. Well, this has some dream scenarios how you could incorporate some sort of segmented water Cherenkov detector with a radio antenna. Then, okay, here is just where we are today. So we have shown with the existing radio arrays, Tomka, LOFA, AERA, that this radio technique is mature. We can use this now as a tool to do our physics goals. The radio emission physics is now pretty much under control, better than 10%. And for the reconstructing air shower observables, we are quite competitive here. If you look at energy resolution, Xmax, mass resolution, and angular resolution, we are in the sort of state of the art area. Well, then if we think of G cost, then the cost of a radio antenna is rather small, and it has the benefit of providing data for mass composition. And I guess this is the main conclusion here of this slide. Well, I said the energy calibration, we probably people know this paper we have in PRL and also one in PRD, that the radio emission gives a very clean calibration candle. So we can use this as a standard candle for the energy scale. And also very recently, these are slides from the ARENA conference from 3-4 weeks ago. This is an example here where with AERA for vertical showers, so with a relatively dense array, if you have this, then what we compared here is Xmax completely independently reconstructed and then compared to FD. So these are really two independent measurements and you see they agree quite well. And this plot here is in principle from the SNOMAS paper, where you see with a dense array, you get quite competitive here with the resolution on Xmax. But I think the main reason why I want to show this here is that we should move to this sort of plots, because I think since the atmosphere is a calorimeter, you always have this energy dependence. And I think quoting just fixed numbers for the resolution is sometimes a little bit misleading. So I'm very happy that in SNOMAS we went to this sort of plots, because then, yeah, otherwise some people quote here, then of course they are very good. Other people quote here and then they are very bad, but it's all the same. In this plot, you see then what it is. And for Chico's, I would advocate we do something like this. Now, how feasible is this? This is just an example of what we are doing at the moment at Auger. We are building this 3,000 square kilometer radio detector where the idea is here. Roughly, we use the water Cherenkov detector for muons and then the radio antenna for the electromagnetic component. We basically have two for Auger, we have two science applications here. One is in this denser grid. The idea is to do particle physics together with the underground muon detector, and then for the 15 nanometer grid, do horizontal air showers, do mass separation with in a hybrid mode, and also for neutrinos and photons. Obviously, this is an interesting thing. And as I said, there will be more comments on the neutral particles. I don't know, maybe tomorrow we come to grid sizes for SD, because there could be that, I don't know, there is at least the tendency that I think SD probably is aiming for a little bit bigger grid sizes than radio, because the LDFs are different. So I don't know, we have to see when we discuss concrete numbers here, but this is not necessarily a showstopper. Huh? You could, I think you probably need a little bit denser array for radio. And what you could do is if you have a, I considered here triangular grid, if you have a SD baseline on a triangular grid, you could have, of course, center stations with radio only, which then would be relatively cheap. And then automatically you have a denser array for radio. And this is one unitarity cell. Then you have to copy paste this. Or the other thing is, if you have, this is now one of the triangular grid stations, you could have satellite radio stations. This is, for example, I think the IceCube people, Frank Schroeder and colleagues, are considering something like this, that you have a central station, which then is a water Cherenkov detector plus radio. And then this could be 50-ish meters, the arm length. So you could just dig locally. This would then be a slave station. This RD thing would be a very simple thing, probably only an antenna, pre-amplifier, and a few meters cable. So you need a landowner who is friendly and allows digging. But if you think of a Auger-type, desert-like place, probably people don't object. But these are too many details for now.
Yeah, what does the 50 meter do? If locally, then you have
locally,
but you still have a very sparse grid.
Yeah, but locally you have then 4 points. And then this goes together with the lower part of the slide. So at the moment, many of these installations, Tonka, Auger, we look at this 30 to 80 megahertz. But if we look at the wider frequency range, like Ariana, Steve Barwick and colleagues do, there's a lot of information in the frequency spectrum. Like if you measure the spectrum, you know where you are in the shower geometry relative to your Cherenkov cone. So with this, these satellite stations here in this Mercedes star configuration, you would gain a lot because you have these four stations and then you can do interferometry because they have the same clock and so on. So there's a lot of information which you would get there from this local station. And the geometry you can still get from the water Cherenkov detector. But then I don't know, we have to think what the application would be. There could certainly be the calibration case, because then you have a subsample of your showers would be the golden ones for vertical.
The fractions that you cover with that.
This small, digital. Yes. Yeah. But for horizontal air showers, I think we are in business. There will be, I think, Thomas and Washington have prepared some slides on footprints. And then I know that Washington did some, we will see this in a few minutes, some how the Senate dependence goes. And you're right, for vertical, it's we have to see how this is. Huh? And I think then we have to, these lower three lines, it's just, there needs to be some work done in this working group. There is the bandwidth needs to be considered, and also how many polarizations do we want. At the moment, we often have two, north, south, east, west. But for example, if you look at our grant colleagues, they have also a third component, a vertical pole. I think we have to look into this. And then Washington and Harma online, they recently published this paper on interferometry. So if you have very good time resolution, then also with only a few stations, you can do a lot with this interferometry. And I was actually, Tim was pointing out that there might be some sort of for free with this new system, this Galileo system, which is sort of the successor of GPS. Apparently there we get, as people promise, centimeter resolution in space. And if you translate this, this must be way sub nanosecond time resolution for us. And then of course, this would be very cool if you would then have your, I don't know if this also is interesting for SDE, for arrival time fluctuations, but definitely for radio, this sort of precision of the timing would be really, really nice. And this is something which just comes to us for free. Huh? These are other people doing this for us, this Galileo. And it's just two slides on this wider frequency range. People in Antarctica, Ariana is mainly a neutrino detector where they look in ice for this Ascarian effect, but they also, as a byproduct, they look for downgoing air showers where the radio signal develops in air. And this is a plot from their astroparticle physics paper. They have now, you see here, up to 500 megahertz, and then you can nicely measure this slope of the radio frequency spectrum. And then this tells you where you are with respect to the Cherenkov cone. And there's a lot of information in there, which helps you to determine your energy and mass. And I think this is certainly something that the working group has to study and make some simulations. And well, then this is just a little bit, this slide is stating the obvious, that we, like in for the water Cherenkov detectors with this SWGO, there are synergies. And I think here we have to see with Grant, I'm in discussion there with some people for the electronics, what we discussed in the morning, if you want to have just some chip that the whole station is on one chip, then certainly this helps if you have more, if you have several groups, because then you can produce in bigger quantities and it becomes more feasible to do this. And these are the few thoughts, and this is, we will have three more talks here. So, points for questions, discussion. Well, of course, it's true that the air shower signal gets weaker because at some point you lose the coherence length. So this is also, you can go infinitely high, but it's also the galactic noise, of course, also drops if you go to higher frequencies. So this is in your favor. And you are talking more about human. I'm sure there are plots in particular from Tim, but I don't have them here right now. But this is something we can look into. Yes.
You could also think also about the locations of detectors.
Yeah. Well, it's a question. In an Auger type environment, it's okay. This we know. And the question is, of course, technically, theoretically, you could put a SD water Cherenkov detector in a city, which is extremely radio dirty. But for practical reasons, do you want to, with landowner and so on? I think, isn't this always that we end up in some sort of more very sparse populated area, which is more some desert type, because a farmer doesn't really want this in the middle of his field. This is in an Auger type environment where there is more or less nothing, then you can put this. And I don't know, is this by definition, we are always in these more remote locations. And then it's also already acquired. I don't know.
We have different pulses and frequencies, right? Pulses, of course, like at the game, like us or whatever running around and transformators, which are especially in the city very dirty. But then, of course, you have frequencies like radio transmitters, like radio, right? And I mean, for this, we know you have directly have to, you really have to go to the South Pole, because I mean, the number you have still a lot of transmitters. Right? But then, of course, these mono frequencies are somehow possible to filter out, right? To some degree. I mean, we would need to discuss this more in detail, but mono frequent signals are not a problem for triggering, for example. Or less a problem.
More points. Doesn't seem to be the case. Then we have Julian as the next. I guess you have to sit here for the microphone. No?
Or I shout.
Or you shout, but I don't know, maybe you sit here.
Yeah.
I sit further away if you are, have corona concerns.
So, okay, just some simple. Oh, sorry. Okay, that's not good. I was starting. Whoops, what happened now? That was not what I wanted. Sorry about that. To share again. Okay, so I mean, as Jack already mentioned, there's this problem of the aperture and of the spacing. So for the RD, we went especially for horizontal showers, for the RD of Auger, so radio upgrade of Auger Prime. So we're looking at 60 to 85 degree, because then the shower footprint is large enough to register on this spare array like this 1.5 kilometer grid we have in Auger. But then, of course, I mean, you get into this regular array trap. And I mean, in principle, you should also have it in. For the standard showers, I mean for the standard techniques like water Cherenkov, but of course you have for some azimuthal directions you have a large spacing between lateral spacing between the detectors, and I mean if you think about the direction of the shower, and then of course in the ground, if you go in the direction of the symmetry of the array, then you of course get, if you go down the direction in the direction of the shower, the spacing gets smaller and smaller. So you could think of about increasing the spacing to compensate for this. But of course, if you think about lateral, then of course increasing the spacing, this would lead to really big gaps, right? And then of course you have, for example, one line, so one point in the lateral distribution functions, but not several ones. So you get a big gap. And for radio with a small footprint, this would lead basically to just one position in the LDF. So this would be very bad. So this 2 kilometer grid definitely will be difficult for radio. One idea, of course, would be an irregular grid. And I guess this is also why I asked Alan about this. Right, because this, of course, would then you, of course, you could have wider spacing, and then you could compensate. You would not get these holes in the laterals in the lateral direction.
But then it needs to be some like white noise that's really random, huh? Not yes, like the
exactly.
Other arrays. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
And then I hope that these things average out, like threshold and so on.
Exactly. So if you think about the photons, for example, just to give you an idea about the aperture, then of course the AC analysis is using this circuit to 60 degree. RD would use then 60 to 85, which in the end, because of the effective area of the array, which is reduced, only adds up something like 30% of aperture. But what is also important, this is what I show you in the plot below, this is from RD science case. You see that with the RD, we'll add sky coverage. here in the red. This is the red one. So this 60 to 85 degrees, and I mean this will come for cosmic rays, but for photons the same. You add sky coverage using the 60 to 65. It's not so much about adding the aperture, but more about adding sky coverage. And of course, in addition, if we look at photons, and this is here a plot from the photon analysis, and then you see that the blue points is Monte Carlo, and we have the definition that we look at, that we do the selection because of the separation between hadrons and photons is so bad, we only use 50% of Monte Carlo efficiency. So the black line is here the cuts on where we actually select then signals to the right. And of course, with radio, we would increase very much the separation between photon and hadrons. And so we could get to something like what we have in the neutrinos, basically a perfect separation, and could there get something like a factor of two larger efficiency for the photons. So this would be the advantage, for example, of radio for the photons. And of course, also what Marcus already mentioned, it's also important to trigger the stations because the radio would mean you would have a perfect electromagnetic trigger, like Marcus said. And I mean, we have this first study with a simple threshold and then a veto on many bins, many large high amplitude bins, because this is then vetoing light background. And so for real noise data, what we see is that we can really get a very effective one with what is now G units, 25 AC count. So you could increase from the triggering from without RD on 65 to 685 degree to having RD in as a trigger with a 25 AC count threshold. You would improve, of course, a lot the triggering rate of the stations. And for instance, this is an example event, Monte Carlo, so full detector simulation of Auger, and you see that there's no trigger of the water tanker detector, but there are many, many stations which are triggered from radio. So this would be a very interesting event that you would definitely see with radio. And I mean, we also have events, just to have an idea of, I mean, we have this engineering area of radio stations in the field. That this is only a few stations, so they are not these very beautiful events, but just to get an idea that you really see this. This is the S left, on the left is the SD. So this is the real band from this year. This is the SD footprint. And actually here is one of the stations where we have radio signals. You see, for example, here we don't have a surface detector, a water triangle detector signal, but on the radio we have it. So you have really a very clear signal in this one that you can use for triggering and so on. So, and this is only, I mean, I would have loved, of course, to have something like the station, which is more here, upwards here, because there definitely would really get a trigger from the radio, and which is not triggered by particles anymore. But also here in the middle, you see that there's no SD signal anymore. So also here, a radio trigger would be very important. There are some other points. This already was mentioned by Björn. So what Tim also put into the discussion, it might be possible in future with Galileo, with atmospheric corrections, to get into sub-nanosecond synchronization, which would be necessary for interference analysis. Another option would be a wide rapid on WLAN. And I mean, this is really something which might pop up until we really want to deploy GSOS. And the interference analysis, of course, is something which is very important for the sensitivity on the X-mass also. So this would be very important there. And there are possibilities, but it's hard to foresee until the deployment and GCOS how far this commercial development will be until then. This is to keep in mind. Another one was point from Frank Schröder, was about the antenna design. This is definitely something where we can gain still a lot. Because one of the important points that he is making is something like grand. I mean, you're looking for neutrino events. So you're looking really for discovery. You're not looking for a perfect energy scale or something like this. You're looking for a discovery of neutrino events. which means, of course, you want to have a very high sensitivity and don't care so much about the systematics. But for GCOS, we really want to go to a high precision. So we want to go to antennas which have a wide frequency band, which are easy to calibrate so that you have low systematics, that have low ground sensitivity, like our cellular antennas, for example, we have an RT, which have a flat sensitivity, because of course, if you have highly directional sensitivities changing, then of course, this also adds up in systematics. And of course, also the influence on manufacturing or alignment, of course, should be low. So we, of course, want to have a robust design, which will, by intrinsic design, will keep these systematics low. And of course, it would also be nice to have an one which is less sensitive to environmental anthropogenic threats or animal threats, right? I mean, if you would, of course, I always was dreaming about an antenna, so you would have just the antenna on the stick and could put the stick into the ground. Then, of course, it would be easy to deploy them, even like we had like the 50 meter from the station design or something like this. So for this kind of deployment, of course, an easy antenna design would be very important. And this is definitely something where we could gain still a lot in the antenna design. And again, I mean, the point of Frank is we are heading for a precision measurement, not for discovery. So we really have to think about more about making this robust and controllable. Yeah, and that was all from my side.
Thank you, Julian. Questions? Discussion? No hand on Zoom, nobody in the room.
I mean, I had a question. I would have a question. You just showed the efficiency for photons with this radio trigger. And for me, a rather low 25 ADC count threshold for this trigger. Is that something realistic? Is that something where we need large comms? Is that something we can do in OG or just for GCOS?
When we have engineering area data that we have at the moment, it's perfectly realistic. We see time periods where there's more noise. So there will be, it might be that we cannot reach this 25 for 24 hours a day. But for most time of the day, this is really realistic from what we see. But it might also depend on the position, right? If we're closer to the upper line or so, then of course also this might be introduced more noise. From what we see, we have data which make which shows that it's really feasible for this in the field.
Okay, thank you.
More remarks? No, then, well, there's still time to discuss. Huh? Then, Washington, do you want to go next?
Yeah, that's fine. So I'll share my screen. Can you see my screen full?
Looks good.
Okay, so this is kind of a wish list for what an RD detector at GCOS would be nice to have. Of course, it will depend on what you're looking to detect. So the first thing is like, Julian already said, I think Jörg actually, it would be nice to have a vertical polarization because there are many geometries where the vertical polarization is the main polarization, like showers coming from the west or east or something like that. And these also have like 90 degree alphas, so they should have a nice signal. Of course, antenna spacing, as the density increases, the energy and zenith angle thresholds decreases. So you have more of the flux being visible. I'll show some plots later. So I'm just giving you an idea, but I'll discuss more later. So in the case of downgoing neutrinos, a denser array is really important because most of these neutrinos will interact closer to the ground where the density is higher. So their footprints are much smaller than regular showers coming from the same direction. And of course, tau neutrino events coming from mountains, if you want to detect those, of course, they are already very close. So their footprints will be tiny. So you really need a denser array. Well, if you want to go with a less dense array, then you can only see very, very inclined showers. So you have to take into account that you have to have like a nice beam pattern that gives you some gain close to the horizontal. So, and that's even more important in the case of this very important channel for neutrinos, which is the upgoing tau neutrinos. So these showers are upgoing and the tau has to decay close to the ground and so that you have X-max close to the ground. And the Cherenkov cone of these showers, they must be nearly at the ground or at the ground in order for you to detect something. So since this angle is smaller than 2 degrees, basically anywhere, then you really need to be able to see a signal coming nearly horizontally. Another thing that was already touched by people is we need a radio-only trigger, I think, in my opinion. It's very important for nus and gammas. And these, of course, are mostly do not generation of muons. And even regular showers, if you are looking at very, very inclined showers, electron neutrino charge currents, you have a problem triggering with an SD array. And of course, sub nanosecond time calibration would be nice so that you could do nice interferometry. So here's to have an idea of the sizes of the footprints as a function of the zenith angle. So here on the background, I plotted just a regular array with 1 kilometer spacing to have an idea of the size and what you can and cannot see. So if you if you're looking at something like an 85 degrees, you can have a very, very, very sparse array, no problem. You sample the footprint very well. As you can see, also the signal goes up as the zenith angle decreases because basically the shower is smaller, it's closer. Mind you. So with something like a 1 kilometer spacing, we can go down to like 65 degrees, 60 degrees maybe, because most of the information is in the central part of the footprint. Of course, as I increase energy, these footprints, these detectable footprints will increase in size, up to a point where you lose information because you're so far away from the central part that has this structure, but you still trigger. So you're like 5-6 times the distance to the Cherenkov ring, but you still have enough, it's kind of a noise from the shower itself, but there is little information there. So although you could trigger, you would have very little information about that shower. So something like a 55 degrees would be very, very, you cannot take much information from a 1 kilometer array. So these showers would not be seen very well. This is just an exercise to see what's the effect of decreasing this the distance between the antennas. So here we have to look for the bang for your buck. So do we want a very, very large area with a lower aperture for especially lower energies? These are regular showers, so this part is not really interesting, low energy regular showers, but for neutrinos it is. So this is what you would gain at lower energies and lower zenith angles if you have like a 1 kilometer to a 750 meter distance. So this would be like the infills that York proposed, he showed you have a central station and like outlier antennas, slave antennas, something like that could be done. Now going for the ongoing neutrinos. Of course, you have a new variable, which is where in the atmosphere the neutrino interacts. So of course, most of the interactions will occur closer to the ground because of the density. And this is, there is very little difference if you move. This is like 75 grams from the top of the atmosphere. And this is 1725. So if you're in the very low density part of the atmosphere, there's not much difference because the shower develops very slowly. But as you the interaction starts to go to lower parts of the atmosphere, which is much more likely, you have this shrinkage of the footprint. So most of the neutrinos that are coming down and interact, of course, will be this sort of very short, very small footprint. So again, I have like a 1 kilometer array on top here so that you could see what we could sample from this footprint. So looking at neutrinos, if you have like a 1.5 kilometer spaced array, you see a very low aperture at the lower energies. This is very important, I think, for neutrinos because like, oh, okay, here I have electron neutrino charge current interaction. So the energy of the neutrino is basically the energy of the shower. But if I go to other flavors or neutral currents, what happens is that you can have something like only 20% of the energy on average from the neutrino going into the shower. So you would be hard pressed to have a shower at 10 to the 20, let's say, depending on which estimate of the flux you go for. The peak for cosmogenic neutrinos would be around 10 to the 18th or 10 to the 19th on other models. So if you have 20% of that, we would be relegated to this shower energy. So decreasing the spacing will actually gain us a significant aperture at this lower energy. So I think this is important. Now for upgoing tau neutrinos, well, the tau decays that occur close to the ground can be seen by antennas. So you have the tau coming out of the ground and it decays close to the ground, and you have like the Cherenkov cone, and you have two kind of geometries that you can look. You have this hyperbolic footprint, so the ring is not a ring anymore, it's a hyperbole. And this is where your signal, your biggest signal would be. And the other geometry is when you have the Cherenkov cone slightly above the ground. So now you have these center antennas with the highest signal because they are closer to the Cherenkov cone. So this is just a simulation of an event at a tau decay at 1 eV that decays right after it enters the atmosphere. And this is what you would see in a triangular array of 1.5 kilometers. So you have a very, very long signal, but in this case it's very, very narrow. So you only trigger this line, kind of line of antennas. And mind you that this is without taking into account any gain of the antennas or antenna pattern. So this is just a signal that if you had like a perfect gain, you would be able to trigger. So if you have a very bad gain for nearly horizontal showers, which is the case here, because this is about 1.5 degrees, so you have to be within 2 degrees of the horizontal to be able to see those, then you would be hard-pressed to see something like a 1 eV tau decaying. If you go even closer to the horizontal, if we could be able to see this kind of very, very horizontal events, then the picture gets much better because we have a much larger signal. So this is now this geometry here. So we have a wider part that could possibly trigger. And you have also a very, very long footprint. So that's why one would be, and I think this is the most important neutrino channel. And so it would be very important to be able to see showers, nearly horizontal showers with, I don't know exactly how to do that. So diminish the effect of the ground, have a very high pole or something to be able to see these showers. And that's all I had to say.
Thank you very much, Washington. Discussion, questions, comments. People getting exhausted, I guess.
Washington, sorry, maybe you mentioned it. What is the peak threshold you assume for having the antennas triggered?
In this simple simulation, I just triggered on 100 microvolts per meter. I have these toy models that I showed. So they're based on full simulations. I just use them to be able to reuse and reuse for several geometries the same simulation. And I just use 100 microvolts per meter. Of course, I can put some kind of antenna pattern there. In the case of the GCOS, I took that out just to illustrate without taking that into account.
Do you have a feeling if muons would trigger water Cherenkov detectors for neutrinos?
I did some simulations, very few actually, but for an electron neutrino, charge current interaction is basically an electromagnetic shower. So yeah, you'd be hard pressed to trigger, especially maybe you trigger one on other stations, but you have like huge holes in it. You have that big, nice footprint in radio and just a few triggers around that. So we need like a radio only trigger. You wouldn't trigger very well with muons, I think.
Thank you.
More comments from the room or from Zoom? No? Then thanks a lot, Washington. Tomas, I think you also have prepared.
Just a sec. Okay, so if you can see my screen, then what I have been doing, I have been working on a graphical front end for Christian Glaser's module, which calculates energy fluence given position of the station and zenith and azimuth and energy of the shower. So I built this. It's not like fully tested, and I will just say a few words. what you can do with it, and you can try it. I put it already on GitHub. So it's basically like you can create like your custom array with some predefined geometries and also predefined station layouts for a square or a triangular. And also you can set like a station distance and also like the number of stations on site, so then your array is bigger. You see then in the panel how many stations there are in the field. Also you can set like the magnetic field vector. By default it's now set to Ogem. And if you are unhappy with this predefined geometries, the circle, the octagon, hexagon, and the classical rectangular, or in other words, square. You can also make your own and then just load it there. And I have this other geometry here defined. It's just only one ASCII file with four columns. The first column is the station number, and the rest of the columns are XYZ station positions. Okay, then you can also set like the marker size, and also you can turn on the magnetic field vector direction so that you can see how it's set. And then, okay, now the most important part is like the shower. You can set here like the azimuth energy of the shower. Also, you can set the core, and then you can send it, and then it calculates like the energy fluence at the stations. Here you can see like the footprint then. This is the shower axis and shower core. And here on this very right side, this is an histogram of the energy fluences of the stations that had energy fluence above threshold, which is defined to 5 eVs per meter square. And then you can see how many stations were like with considerable signal. So in this case it's like 43, and then you can see this distribution here, and you can then change the parameters and look how this changes. And yeah, that's basically all. I would say just try it out and send me feedback. It's just very fresh. I didn't also tested it that much, so it's possible that something isn't completely working fine, but for now I didn't find anything. So this is only to get like the idea, like how many stations you have when you increase spacing, when you change the geometry, when you change the station layout, when you change the shower properties. So this is something that is quite fast and give you at least like a rough idea of where you are. And yeah, this, I will just put this in chat. The prerequisites are by default can be easily installed. Most of them are like the standard libraries. Only two of them are something extra. And this is also mentioned here in the README. Basically, the Christian Glaser's GOCLDF module, which I forked to work for Python 3, that is on this Git, and then Radio tools. And so you just need these two and add it to your Python environment variable, and then it should be completely ready. Yeah. So that's basically all. I will just share this link. And if you find something, just tell me. Okay, so this was all from me.
Thank you very much. Do we have questions, discussion? Maybe a question for me to the ASCII people. This is just a very simple parameterization of the LDF. Huh? If we could have something like this from the particles as well, I think it's very easy for Thomas to build in also, you know, if we have a formula to put in the particles, because then we could very easy when we discuss spacings and so on, see how big the footprints are for electrons, for muons, and for the radio. And yeah, I don't know. I think at some point we need real plots, but I think this is very nice to get a feeling. And so what Michael was discussing about vertical and so on, here one can play a little bit and get a feeling. And then, I don't know. Maybe we should see if we can get parameterizations. Yeah. And then this is a nice tool. At this stage, this would be useful.
Maybe a comment to that. for inclined showers, the muon maps we are using for reconstruction basically give you already a prediction for the particle density, right? So it's basically that it would just need to be kind of made available for such a tool.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one question from my side to Tomas. So do you use the original parametrization of Glaser? Because that was just used or validated for vertical showers. And since he uses splines for all the parametrization, I'm not sure how nice that extrapolates to higher zenith angle. Or do you use something which Florian Brichle did, but which was never brought to really being worked with?
Sorry, I was muted. That part I'm not completely, I don't remember, because that is part that I used quite some time ago, and I took that function to this code, so I don't remember, but I think that this is just the original Glaser's formula. So if there is something that can be improved here, it's very welcome.
Yeah, then a caution. I think that's not validated for showers beyond 60 degrees, and I would be a bit worried how these splines extrapolate actually.
I think we could easily compare with some of my showers, so that should be easy to do. So you generate the energy fluence, and I transform my electric field to energy fluence, and we compare both.
Now we can then talk about it.
Sorry, we were here not connected anymore and lost some of the part of the discussion here in the room. Can you hear us now?
I can.
Let's switch off the microphone because I don't get connected to the.
It's on. So,
okay. But then, okay, so I have now. We lost some of the discussion, but I saw there was a hand of Kaiden. And failed. And since we were cut off, I'm not sure if all the things were answered.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Thomas, can you show again this event that you had on the screen? I mean, is the pink cross, is that the core of the shower? Because it seems to be on the edge of the footprint.
Let me show again.
I think you had two events. One event that you showed during your talk, and then another one that you showed.
I can set it wherever you want.
You have to produce it again. Yeah.
Whatever. Let's use this. Yeah, this pink is. You can set it where you want it. I basically by default put it always in the middle of the array somewhere. But you can easily change it.
Okay, but is that the core of the shower?
Yeah, this is here should be like the impact point of the shower.
But why do you have it always at the edge of the shower?
No, this isn't edge. The cross is. This is just like the shower axis.
Right, but you see that the footprint is red, where the red points are. The core should be. More or less there, right?
Yeah. It's basically inclined. So. Yeah, like I said, needs to be a little more, but if you have like a feeling that it doesn't make sense, then.
I don't know. I thought the core should be closer to the, but maybe there's a huge early late effect here. I don't know.
Yeah, I share your feeling, Jaime. And I, as far as I know, there's no early late effect or correction to that matter in this model. from Christian, at least in the original version.
But that's the cross is really the core position, because it looks as if every time you plot it, it's at the center of the array for everything.
Yeah, so, the core is here, because I set it here, but I can give you core wherever you want to have it. Okay, like I said, the core is basically, I am throwing it by default here in the middle.
So that's the impact point you're saying?
Yes.
It doesn't, the impact point of the shower axis, but it doesn't.
Yes, basically where the shower axis crosses the ground plane.
Okay, but then this doesn't make too much sense to me, but I mean, maybe there's just some bug in the display or something. Just for you to have a look at it, for instance, this one is even more dramatic.
So you think that it should be more like here, right?
Well, that's what I thought, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, there's something wrong there. Okay, you have some lateral dislocation because...
Now I'm kicked out.
Okay, now I can see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So when I agree with Kai, I had that
naive
center of gravity.
Sorry.
Wouldn't we expect that the center of gravity of the footprint is? Can I try that?
No.
Okay, now we don't hear you.
Now you should hear us again?
Yes, now we do.
Yes.
Then I try to say what I tried to say. That as a climate, and also I have the feeling that is the center of gravity of the footprint, should this be where the shower axis crosses the plane? And somehow, I don't know, maybe a little too naive or something is wrong in this. But at least for particles, the center of gravity is where the axis crosses the plane. And I think this is also for the radial radiation.
And sure.
But isn't this some, do you see this at this scale? From this scale, that is very rough. You see the like, step size. Is this really so dramatic that the process and at the edge of the
even if the is perfectly symmetric with respect to the axis, then the infection will come here. It's a whole problem in motion. That the structure seems symmetric, but the fact the projection cosine is different. Yes, this makes an asymmetry.
So, but you think it's reasonable that this process is always at the edge of the graph statement? Okay, but I think there's maybe too much to know the game. I don't know, it's a numerical thing or it's real. Okay, and then your chat, Felix is commenting that maybe this is not the most sophisticated thing, but I think, yeah, also as Felix writes already in the chat, I think if we have a more sophisticated model with the early late and so on, these can be implemented. I think that the nice thing is we have this tool, if people have for particles some parameter station, you could put it in there. And I think this is to get a feeling, this is to get a rough feeling of how would you design a layout, and I think what is good enough. More comments from?
Yeah, if I can say something else, so something to think about is of course the topography of the site or sites, given what Washington has shown us, that if you have a planar array, then it's very, very difficult to see the Earth skimming neutrinos. But if you have mountains, as if they're going to put the ground in China in some mountain range or whatever, then this can improve the efficiency of tiny trees. So, okay, that's something to think about over your dinner, for instance, since you're going for dinner now. It's too early for Spain. And that's all, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Kyle. This is a good part. We are, according to Indico, we are almost finished for the day. Any final comments? Okay, there is in the chat, it's a comment from Washington, just by this. For your station for 565 degree shower with a normal expanse, the core is 20 meters away from the center.
Yeah, that was just to illustrate that actually the core is not at the center. If you think of the footprint as an ellipse that you can calculate from the Cherenkov cone, the core at the ground where the axis crosses the ground is actually towards one side, and it's more and more distance from the center of the ellipse as you incline more and more the shower. But it's very small compared to the actual distance to the end of the footprint. So it's a small difference.
Yeah. Well, the 20 meters we will not see on the scale we have on the screen. No, but what Washington Wright said, 1600 meters maybe we could see there. But this we need to follow up offline. Yes, this is not too complicated. Should we then, I guess it's getting late, at least for here. I know you still have some time, but here people want to have a beer and dinner. So maybe we should
Yes, we should have a question. Okay, I'm not committed to exactly G curse. I'm just doing the next one. So what is the position of G curse with respect to Gauss? Is it, should we consider that G curse is different projects that both develop independently, or maybe they will converge to something common? Maybe we can right now. I was asked by somebody, divergent.
Well, I'm not sure if we can conclude on this right now, but of course, at the moment, it's a different project, but of course, we are in a friendly relation. For example, very recently, at this Arena radio conference with several of us at long talks with, for example, Olivier Martino, what I also said with electronics and so on. I think we have to think of synergies because everybody is developing his own thing, this is not very efficient. And also, I think in terms of sites, I think Grant is thinking of multiple sites, and Chico's also. And I don't know, we have to see that. Definitely, we have to be in friendly relations and not in competition, because it's always there. We have to share voice at the end. And we have to see, it could also be that, I don't know, we have different sites. Some are more radio, more Grant like, some are more practical like Chico's. Yeah. Yeah, we have to talk to each other and see how this develops. But it's certainly a very important point.
Okay. Anyway, I don't want to in my opinion. Okay, just for
one point of view, yes. But otherwise, like regime has because they would put antennas on the mountain and I don't think they use the cross. So do you think it makes sense to have it on the same side?
I don't know, to our cheapest friends, to Charles and I, they are more and more thinking also to add particle detectors. Not only in the beginning, this was radio only, now they also made some discussion if they want to have some sort of particle detector. I don't know. To me, it looks like it's not so different anymore as it was in the beginning. And then in the beginning, it was neutrinos only. Now they are also speaking about charged cosmic rays. I don't know. We have to see around.
This was down 300. First, then they want to measure something, otherwise, they measure nothing. So they need to also measure charge quantities. So I don't know. I think we should be careful with your.
Okay, but maybe discussing for tomorrow. We don't need to solve everything. But it's also a good point for you. And then I think we sort of, past 7 here and our time starts. So I propose we close. And then tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, our European time zone, we continue, whatever this is, your local time zone. And then, thanks a lot for. Our European time zone. And then, thanks a lot to all people in the room and on Zoom. And then see you tomorrow. Thanks. Bye. There's the room here. Need some instructions from Julian where to go for whatever we agree.